When looking for the King of Podcasts, you're at the wrong channel.
Well, excuse me!
Looking for good ideas for life? You're far from good hands.
Hey, bud, what's your problem?
If you think the listener is always right, you're far from the right place.
Out of order! Even in the future, nothing works!
Hosted by a Northeasterner by birth, but a rebel by choice.
Are you threatening me?
If you want a host that floats between love and madness,
and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite, looking forward to a little afternoon delight.
Then play on and listen to Crazy Train Radio.
All right, guys, listen to this blues riff and B. Watch me for the changes and try and keep up, okay?
Warning, creators of this game do understand the subject matter may be offensive to some, but they do honor the families and people that have been affected by these real life tragedies that these individuals have caused. Want to play a game?
Oh yeah!
Lover of true crime?
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, we got an interesting game for you to check out.
Wow.
With the mashup of influences such as horror movies, collecting cards, and RPGs.
What?
Led to giving birth to an incredible creation of this game, Killers the Card Game.
You are all my children now.
This game is a collectible trading card game featuring some of the most infamous killers with tidbits of trivia on the back of each card to help you learn some insight to each criminal.
Who the hell are you?
Let's not forget, during the game, cops will be chasing you and these criminals.
I'm a cop, you idiot!
However, check out their website listed through all social media today, which can be found under Killers the Card Game.
Am I on the internet?
I want to play a game.
Hi, this is Joyce Poshton, AWA Pro Wrestling author. You're listening to Crazy Train Radio, home of all things pro wrestling and pop culture. Enjoy.
Hey folks, it's your least favorite host in the podcast world, Croc, Jonathan Steele. And boy, do we have a good one for you today.
All right, everybody. We are back here. I wanted to bring a friend to the show. I wanted Jonathan to meet her. She is one of the sharpest wrestling historians, one of the few wrestling photographers we have, and she's mega as a photographer, an AWA historian because she grew up, you know, right in the kind of one of the hearts of it. She has a brand new book out that's awesome. It really is, and for anybody that loves the AWA, if you don't even love or appreciate the AWA, so many wrestlers, everybody came through there, from Gene Kaniski to the best Shawns, obviously Hulk Hogan. But the book is entitled My Ringside Seat to the AWA by author Joyce Poshton, Paustian. My photos and stories from the American Wrestling Association and Sergeant Slaughter, Bob Remus did the foreword. But this is a unique book in the way it's laid out. There's ticket stubs, how she became a fan, but she goes into detail. There's program lineup sheets. I was just telling Pampero Furpo's daughter, she has to get this book because he's in it. And Joyce, when did you start work on this? Because again, you are the first, as I'm going to be writing about all over the place, female wrestling photographer to ever put out a book on this planet. Not Linda Ruffa, not Kathy Dowd, not Ruth Oman, all of these female wrestling photography legends. Nobody but you. And it's amazing. So tell us about how this all came about, this book came about.
I grew up in the AWA and I was taking pictures for my own collection primarily. I was a friend of Jim Melby, who ran the Wrestling News, and he had always said if I get any good pictures to send him his way, but I wasn't under contract or being paid or anything. And the AWA had a lot of photographers at the time, male, all but I was there doing it for my own enjoyment and wanting to keep the pictures. And I did keep them in albums and everything all over the years. And then I never really did anything with them. I didn't sell my pictures. I always had requests to, but I didn't feel like I should, or if wrestlers asked me for copies, I would make a copy for them, but I generally wasn't trying to make money off of it. I was just saving them for my own collection. Well, then when the pandemic hit, I kind of started relooking at my albums and thinking, I really should do something with these photos. A few of them had been published in magazines, but the vast majority not. And I thought people would enjoy seeing photos from a different perspective, from a fan perspective. And so I started taking them out. I got them all scanned digitally and cleaned up. And some of them had faded a little bit, but I got them all cleaned up. And then I thought, well, gee, I should do a coffee table book. Well, that would get to be too expensive. And then I thought, maybe I should do my stories about this. So I really went back and forth working on it for 2 or 3 years, trying to decide how I was going to lay it out. And then I stopped for several times and got back started. And then finally, my husband just said, you need to do something with these photos. They're too good to just sit in an album. So I wrote the stories and then put the thing out there. I talked to, as you mentioned, Sergeant Slaughter, and said, you know, would you be willing to write, you know, a foreword for it? You know, give me some credibility. And he said, of course. And Baron von Raschke gave me a blurb on it too. And it just I took off from there. I found out there were a lot of people that had fond memories of the AWA and didn't, like me, didn't buy photos, but had their own photos and just were hungry for those memories.
Well, the photos are extraordinary. Backstage, everything you could want to see, tons of action. I'm going to throw to Jonathan Steele, who's king of the wrestling books and all fighting sport books and more. Jonathan.
Thank you. And I should mention that once this was confirmed yesterday, I actually reached out to a newer buddy who's also from the AWA territory, and Mr. George Shire, and he gave me a nice check or PayPal payment to say nothing but nice things about Joyce. Now, I'm teasing. George said it for nothing, so. But he had ravishing things to say about you and the book and everything else like that. So, yeah, George is a great guy.
Yeah, George and I go way back. We met in 1978. And as you know, he's written several AWA books. And he was a good person to keep pushing me along and saying, yeah, I think there would be a market for this and you should do it. So,
and George, he won't admit it publicly, but the books he's put together, he wrote in crayon. But yes, folks, I'm ribbing here. yes, I got to rib George because I know he'll listen. He listens to everything and whatnot. But
George wrote his from a different perspective. You know, he's supposed to like the history of the AWA and results and things. And so mine was a little different. I wanted to talk about my experiences as a kid, just being in awe of the AWA and then like Beck mentioned, just some of the trials and tribulations of being a woman in primarily a man's domain.
Yeah, well, we'll start there then. So what was that like, being a woman in a or around a male dominated field?
It was hard to get taken seriously, and part of that is my own fault because I didn't have a good camera right away. I had just an Instamatic camera, and I thought that would be good enough. I was buying, you know, tickets to ringside, so I didn't have a place at ringside, but I wanted to take pictures, and I didn't really know that much about photography at the time, but I worked up toward it, where I took some college courses. I got a 35mm camera, and still it was hard to get in my foot in the door, because some of the referees were especially in the Illinois Commission, were very reluctant to have a woman at ringside. They were concerned I'd be hurt or wouldn't get out of the way in time. And of course, I wasn't allowed in the dressing rooms like some of the other photographers. And then I think there was an assumption that I wanted to do it so I could get closer to some of the guys, you know.
So,
and that was not my motivation at all. It was, I wanted to have pictures published in a magazine and write stories, but just didn't have the connections to do it until I really got to know Jim Melby pretty much and Mike Kretschner, mostly through the Wrestling Fans International Association at the time. They helped me. That's all I was going to say.
Well, what I was going to follow up with was there eventually somebody AWA-wise that had went to bat for you to try to help you confirm your credibility?
Not so much in the AWA themselves, although I became good friends with Nick Bockwinkel, and he was
there's a good story there I've heard, but
very supportive. But mostly it was Norm Kietzer and Jim Melby and George Shire through the wrestling news guys who helped me, because I wasn't looking to make money off the photos. But so many of the AWA promoters were afraid that the people that taking pictures would try to sell the photos on their own. And they had this thing of nobody's going to make money off of photos except us. And so they didn't want people taking pictures that weren't good, that you didn't have a contract with a magazine to use. So, yeah.
Mike, this is your wheelhouse. So, do you got something you want to throw in?
Oh yeah. I'm thinking like Bruce Kreitzman. No, I worked, and Norm and Jim had me use different names, which it was the creation of George Napolitano. Like I used my grandfather's name. And others, George Napolitano, way before me, said, you know, because I'm working for all these different magazines, including Starlog Press. So you didn't want like your name everywhere on all this text and all the photos. So sometimes he used his dog's name, Pupo, P-U-P-O, Napolitano, or other times his wife's maiden name, Jacqueline Cortano, etc. But Mike Gratch, so I'm thinking, because we had some powerful legendary women in the WFIA, which Jim Melby and George Shire, Tom Burke, who's like the guru of historians left, and Dave Brzezinski, who was shooting ringside for the Sheik in Detroit, but also writing the program, started. And George Ann Macropoulos, who was like the queen of the wrestling newsletters and fan clubs, you know, she had the Buddy Rogers fan club in the 50s, Bruno's fan club, et cetera, later on in the 60s, and Marilee Needsel, who ran the Valiant Brothers fan club. But were you active? I haven't gotten that far in the book yet, with fan clubs, which was kind of our lifeline. We didn't have sheets or newsletters, but we had clubs. Yeah. And I was on the board, but a little bit later on, once Don Wilson left as president, starting in 74, the WFIA, when Mike Gratchner took over. Mm-hmm. And I stayed at Mike's house quite a few times in Illinois, and So tell us a little about that. Were you active in fan clubs or having
mostly just Nick Bockwinkel's? He was my number one favorite at the time, and I had taken a really good shot of Nick with the belt after he'd won it, and showed it to Mike Ratchner, and he said he encouraged me to enter it. He said you should enter that in the WFIA contest, fan photo contest. He said that would have a good chance of winning, and I submitted it, and it did win, and I showed it to Nick, and he immediately wanted a copy of it. And actually, that's how I met George Shire, too, because he saw it in a magazine. And he said, he's always been a big Bockwinkel fan as well. And he wanted a copy of it. So that kind of got me started. And then that's when Jim Melby told me, if you get other good photos, send them in, and we'll use them and you'll get credit for them. So I did, but I also wanted to keep my photos, so I'd make copies. And then by that time, usually Jim would say, well, we already have enough pictures of that particular match or that particular feud, so didn't get yours used or something like that. Yeah, once in a while, I'd get them in. But then mostly it was because Mike became promoter in Peoria, Illinois, and he needed publicity shots for the matches, the ads, and the posters that he was doing. So I became the number one photographer for that, at least. And that was both the AWA and WWA at the time. So,
right, because that funny story, because so I'd stay at his house, and then he would drive, or he'd let me take over, because these were long drives from Illinois through Oklahoma to St. Louis, and then we'd come back for Chicago. Probably the greatest, and one of my favorite venues, as Jonathan knows, was the Chicago Amphitheater. Saw a couple of riots, insanely great fans. But when Bruiser and Crusher beat Nick and Ray for the tag titles, I think it was 77, and the place just went ballistic. But Mike Gratchner was then transitioned from photographer, and he loved promoting for Vern, but then he called it the motion to promoting for Dick the Bruiser's WWA in the same city, and he didn't enjoy it as much. So I wanted to ask, are you still in touch with him? Because he was going to try to make my St. Louis Sam Muchnick Weekend for the Boys convention in 1991, but was not in good health at that time, like Larry Matisick wasn't doing good that, but he still came. But I was wondering, and you'd probably be the only one that's keeping in touch other than George with Mike.
Yeah, he kind of stepped away from wrestling for a while. We kept in touch early in the 2000s when he was doing Windy City Wrestling as an independent partner. But then I kind of lost touch with him for a while. And you're right, he did have some health issues for a while. But then I called him after I did this book, because I told him, I was going to mention him as a mentor or somebody that helped me get my foot in the door. And he didn't really think I needed to tell him that, but we talked on the phone, and I was going to Chicago for a sports event at the time. And so we got together for lunch. So, and he's now doing very well. In his 80s, but he's doing very well, and we had a really great time catching up. So I was able to thank him for all he had done, and he hasn't really been in touch with any of the guys. He was very close to both Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzell, and every time I'd see the two of them, they'd ask me, "Do you ever talk to Mike?" And I'd have to say, "No, I kind of lost touch," and so now I'm waiting. When I see them in May, I'm going to tell them, yes, I talked to Mike.
I'm going to throw back to Jonathan, but I remember at the time, mid-70s, Mike Gratchner was like, even though he was a professional photographer, he was Jim Brunzell's number one fan. You know this. And he was doing all this stuff. And then he got tickets to Brunzell's a couple of years later to his favorite musician of all time, Bruce Springsteen. And so when Brunzell and Gagne and Blair were all together at Cauliflower Alley, I kept, just a couple of years ago, or when they started, Jim came a couple of years in a row. I asked him if you remember all this stuff, and I go, "What about your biggest mark, Mike Gratchner?" But anyway, I'll throw back. You know what, Jonathan, you might want to ask her about, she was there, I think, the night when Vern Gagne's AWA, the original title belt, was stolen.
That's correct.
Well, I'll go there, then we'll go to where I was going to go. Joyce, when was the belt stolen that night, and what actually happened?
Well, it was an outdoor card at the Davenport Ballpark. It was in...
Surprised with those folks from Iowa, but never mind. Go ahead.
And I was there as a fan. This was before I started taking pictures. It made huge news. But it was a Bockwinkel match against Vern Gagne, where Heenan was handcuffed to Larry Hennig. And the announcer had the belt, the old belt, not the inmate belt, but the old eagle belt on the table, just the table outside the ring. And there were no guard posts, or there were police officers there, you know, to keep fans away, but not the kind of security you see today. And there was like a split second between when the bout was over and Gagne had won. But then Heenan tried to interfere, and everybody was focused on Heenan and Hennig outside the ring. And they were trying to get them unhandcuffed, and somebody came along and jumped over the stands, and they must have planned this, I don't know, or else it was just a hunch that they could go get it. And then they grabbed the belt and headed out the side gate of the arena and into a waiting car, as I understand it. But of course, there was just mass confusion. Both Al DeRusha and Greg Gagne ran after the guys, and police officers, of course, ran after them, and they were actually even stopping every car as they went out. But the guys that had taken the belt were already gone, and they were afraid they were going to just trash it. Weeks later, it turned up without the jewels, if you will, and that weren't really as valuable as the AWA would have had you believe, but still, it was still a valuable, beautiful belt, and it showed up without the gems in it, and dumped in a mail chute, and with a note that said, "You've got the wrong guy arrested." And but they did arrest the guy, and they got him because he was showing it off at a bar to people.
Was his name Stan Hansen?
Yeah,
there's a difference between stealing a belt and destroying a belt. I'm sorry, Stan, I never met you. I can't.
No, he destroyed the belt and he sent it via like regular 14
from Japan.
Yeah,
so maybe he got the idea from this guy. No, the guy's name was Tom Fennelly, and he was showing it off to his friends at a bar and said, "I beat Vern Gagne for the title, and I got the belt to prove it." And he took people out to his car and showed them the belt. And so some of his friends turned him in when there turned out to be a reward. And he was arrested, but they never could really, he got sentenced to 5 years in jail for larceny over $20, believe it or not, because they couldn't prove that it was worth more than $10,000 without the
gems. It's all in Joyce's book too, Jonathan.
Yeah. It was a big deal for a long time, and headlines in our paper.
All the magazines.
And of course, then that led to creating a new belt for Nick Bockwinkel with the inmate belt. And it was funny because Nick came on the AWA show that weekend, and I think it was like kind of a precursor to him, or, you know, pre-shadowing that he was going to win the belt that November. This was in July, I believe. And he said, As far as I'm concerned, you didn't steal Vern Gagne's belt. You stole my belt. And I think he probably had already been promised that he was going to get the belt. But so he was quite incensed that the belt had been stolen.
Right. The book is My Ringside Seat to the AWA. I will put a link to Joyce's website, which you can purchase the book. But the book has over 500 photos, many never seen before, over 300 pages, up close personal view of wrestling during the territory days of the 70s and early 80s of the Midwest, which was AWA's hotbed, obviously. They did Vegas, they did Minneapolis, Winnipeg, Chicago, you know, that whole region. But you mentioned Nick as being one of your favorite talent. And I heard a story recently, Joyce, of you talking about first connecting with Nick. I think it was getting an autograph and stuff like that. And you felt like it took time to win him over. Do you mind telling that story?
No, not at all. It's interesting to me that, you know, fans nowadays, or for a while, at least in the 2000s, were coming up and saying, oh, what a great, nice guy Nick is. You know, he's so approachable, so easy to talk to at CAC, because the only way they knew him was from CAC, and he was the president and he was approachable then. But I would kind of laugh to myself, because I think, like, some of the fans of my era in the 70s.
If you only knew.
I said, no, he was not a nice guy or approachable back then, unless you were on the very inside. And that was a very few people at that time, because it was the era of kayfabe. And he was, you know, this ultimate nasty guy. And he was not going to be nice. He had to be aloof and rude, and he used all these big words, and I'll make you think that, you know, I'm being nice to you, but I'm really not, you know. So yeah, it took a long time for me to win more. He didn't trust many people. In fact, he said that at one of our fan club conventions. He says, I don't trust people, and I don't let many people into my world. And so I knew I was up against just a brick wall almost. But he saw me at multiple events, and eventually there I would get asked for enough autographs, and then he finally asked me, what do you do with all these autographs? I think he was concerned I was selling them, and I said, no, they're for my own personal collection. And I think he was concerned that I was going to get in with the wrong crowd or something. And so he kind of made it his own individual effort to keep me away from certain people. You don't want to be around that guy. Stick with this one. You better be careful of this guy, type thing. So I respected that, but I still wanted to know more about him. And it was through the fan club that I learned almost everything about him. And Nick and George probably has told you the same story about how he would see some of the things we do, and he'd just say, oh, you guys are sick. He says, I don't give you any encouragement at all, and you still keep following me around. I don't know why. You know, I just wish you'd go find another life, you know. But yeah, secretly he loved it, and he would I think he would have missed it if we had been going around. So finally, there were times when he, you know, he's toward the end, more toward the end of his career, he started softening up or being more open about things. And he, and you know, and then he would write me autographs later on that to a longtime fan or to a person who I was never nice to, but still kept coming back, you know. So the first time I asked him for an autograph, he told me I had a Black Winkle t-shirt on, and he I said, could I have your autograph? And he said, yes, you seem to be hardworking enough to deserve it. But then it was clear that he didn't want me to stick around. It was like, now scram, kid, you know, kind of thing. And he didn't, I didn't know that I wasn't really supposed to approach him when our other fans could see that he was signing an autograph. I had to learn that he would be happy to sign the autograph later if people didn't see it, but he would come out to watch the matches because he was instrumental in a lot of the youngsters' careers, but he didn't want to be seen as signing autographs. So he would sign the autograph and try to get rid of me as quickly as he could. That was not the right way to approach it.
Well, speaking of collectibles, and you know, before I go there, and it's funny that his name was mentioned a few minutes ago in Bobby Heenan. And obviously his time with the AWA, you know, with Black Jack Lanza and Nick and others was legendary before his WWE run. And the reason I say that's funny that his name came up, which it's not a surprise with the AWA when you talk that history, but I actually heard from, and this is will be news to Mike as well, I actually heard from Bobby's daughter last night. And she will be here at some point. We're going to talk and figure that out. But I had a chance to talk to his daughter, which was cool for me. And there was an actual skit she was telling me about briefly when we chatted. WWF days when they were at the Busch Gardens for a Wrestling Challenge or Primetime. It was for Primetime. Gorilla and Bobby. And the famous thing at the end of the show where a girl steps on the foot, looks like she's assaulting Bobby. You know, you're a weasel, but boom, hits him. It was as a, that was her. Yeah. And they told her to work it, but she let them have it anyway, because that's the type of relationship they had. But
yeah, I saw an interview she did, and she was fabulous and adored her dad, of course, as we all did. And I remember Bobby showing me way back when she was very young, showing me pictures of her. And he told me that she was, and she was a very cute kid, but he told me she had been asked to have her picture on a cereal box at the time. She was so cute. And she's only like 3 years old. But yeah, she's great, great kid. And he was so proud of her.
Bobby's widow, Cindy, was a great, great lady. She took such tender, great care of him all those years. He was suffering from the throat cancer and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And
she just, yeah, and she was the only one that could understand him toward the last few years. And it was amazing how she could translate what he was saying. But she just, it was kind of like they just had the one brain.
So when you're together that long, you're going to have that.
But she, yeah, but very nice lady.
What kind of memories do you have AWA-wise of Bobby back in the day?
Just that he was a riot and a laugh a minute. And his interviews were just second to none. That was the great thing about the AWA back then, was they would tape in separate interviews for every city. And they'd spend like almost all day on Saturday in Minneapolis taping interviews. And he would make references to the individual cities in the ballparks, and he would get people on the screen laughing so hard just by all the different skits that he would do or just references that he made. He did one that was in our local. A lot of times they would go to the local station tributary, whatever you want to call it, and tape a local interview with the local anchor person, so that it really had a feel. So then, but he had been in there, and He found an old bicycle, a kid's bicycle, and he came riding into Nick's interview on this little kid's bicycle. And Nick said, Sir Robert, a new mode of transportation? And he said, well, I heard that this is Greg Gagne's bike, and I heard he's going to have it at ringside when he has to wrestle me. And as soon as he can, you know, get out of the ring, he's going to be so scared. He's going to ride off on this bicycle. it's just classic. I mean, it sounds silly now, but it was
typical Bobby.
Work. Yeah, just off the cuff stuff. And that's the way he was in real life. It's just boom, boom, boom. He could say things so quickly.
What a joke I always remember him saying about Nick. And I don't mean, this is Bobby's words. And so don't hang me by the knuppets or whatever the term would be in Yiddish. But he said, you would ask Nick a question. You know, they'd be going town to town or whatever, you know, in between shows and, you know, doing their thing. Bobby said, you can ask Nick a question. He'll tell you how to build a watch.
That is true. Don't ask him what time it is. Yeah. Yeah, Nick constantly asking questions about everything. He wanted to know everything he could about a certain subject. He would ask me questions about my job and ad nauseum. I mean, like, just go on and on about it and ask that. And then what? And then what does he got to the point of, like, why are you asking all this? And he'd talk about TV documentaries that he had seen during the week and just talk all the time. But the funny thing was, the funniest thing I remember was once that Nick was working for the WWE and Bobby, of course, had already been there and they were doing tapings. And he said Nick had the toughest time keeping the earphones in his ear because they would need to reach him during the day. And Bobby had to go up to Nick and say he had the earphones in his back pocket. And he said, can you hear through these, Nick? And he said, well, no, I took them out because, so he said, well, they've been trying to reach you and you don't have them. Don't have them in your ear, you know. Maybe you should keep them in your ear so when people try to reach you, you get to. And so he says, I went back and said, now repeat after me. Nick is a moron. Nick is a moron. And he, you know, he loved Nick, but that was just Bobby's sense of humor.
Oh yeah, exactly, Mike.
And of course, we're talking to Joyce Paustian, Paustian, the book, My Ringside Seat to the AWA, with a foreword by Sergeant Slaughter, the Sarge. I don't think you have this in your book, but I asked each of them individually because Heenan and Miguel Alonso and Pedro Morales, I had to drive from their hotel to the venues in San Francisco and Oakland when they were with WCW. But Nick, Heenan, Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson in Honolulu working for Ed Francis. I forget the year, 73, 72. Rode on the little motor scooters, mopeds, totally naked up to the Haleakala crater, volcano crater to see the sunrise. You do that at, you know, it's a rite of passage in Maui. So they got off Oahu, went over to the Maui Island to do this, and they had some great classic stories. Also taking the fabulous moolah of roller derby, seven-decade skater who used to co-host my TV show, and Banana Nose Calvello. They gave Pat, Heenan put a Mickey in Pat's drink, as Heenan told me, knocked out Pat. They put him in bed, and when he woke up, they had planted Ann Calvello in bed with him, and then Pat tells all of the rest of the guys, oh, that's the first and last woman I've ever slept with. So that is probably not in your book, but I was thrilled to see because I didn't know that, you know, Vern was instrumental in bringing Iron Sheik, Khosrow Vizari, into the biz with Leroy McGurk, Mike's dad, tremendous promoter in the Midwest. And I'm seeing a great photo you took of him roughing. Was this before he started working as sort of a low-level baby face with his hair on?
Yeah, before the Iron Sheik days. He would wrestle once in a while as Khosrow Vizari, but, you know, he was helping out with Vern's camp that he would run every so often with Billy Robinson, and then he had been a trainer on the for the Olympic team, and yeah, then he would help out with Byrne, and he would do the refereeing. I don't think he ever brought the ring truck, but he did referee once in a while, and then he also would wrestle in some of the earlier bouts. But yeah, it was as Khosrow Vezeri, and then like a year later, he comes back as the Iron Sheik. I guess
Papa.
People have their own level of believability at that time, and the suspension of disbelief. So nobody was at that time. They weren't calling out, "Oh, I know you're Khosrow Vezeri," and they, you know, they just believed that he was the Iron Sheik, and they were willing to boo him then. But yeah, early on, he was a referee.
Your book brought back such great memories, and the way that you have this book reminds me of the Paul Simon documentary that just had its second and last part last night. They're veering between his personal life and the present, and you know, you do that in the book because you're right in Iowa near the Thes Tragas Museum. Did you know Mike Chapman, who started that? You know, he's like the king of amateur history writing, and a great, great.
I didn't at the time, but Carl Lauer was the guy that eventually told me about the museum. I didn't know anything about it being built because I didn't really follow amateur wrestling at the time. I, of course, knew who Dan Gable was, but as everybody in Iowa did, but didn't really follow any of the rest. And I had heard of Mike Chapman, but hadn't met him before that. And then I heard they were doing a joint Cauliflower Alley Hall of Fame event in 99 in Iowa to help launch the museum. And I couldn't wait because, you know, there just was a very, very limited amount of wrestling history or anything in the museum. I knew they were doing something in New York and had done things in California, but this was going to be right near where I could drive to. So I was very excited about that and got to meet Mike, and he's super nice. And I was impressed by how much he liked the pro, the amateurs that had turned pro. I mean, he's very, very impressed by Byrn and Luthez, of course, and Baron and Danny Hodge, of course. But so many amateurs that eventually became really famous pros as well. So I loved the early days of that museum, and it really outgrew its original home there, and they needed to either build on or go somewhere else with it. And then it kind of became too much of an, in my opinion, too much of an amateur-oriented museum. But that's just the nature of having the Dan Gable name on it. And every year the pro wing is a little smaller.
Because it was when I went to the Cauliflower Alley, we instead of doing Vegas, we went there.
Uh-huh.
We moved from our home for 20, 30 years in Los Angeles to Vegas. We did that one. And I'm looking at a photo, as you said that about Dan Gable, I go, wow, she's got a great photo right in her new book of Gagne, Vern Gagne, Dan Gable in the middle, and Lou Thes at that Hall of Fame. So when I was at that, there was a lot more pro, you know, it was maybe a third pro, two thirds amateur, but it sounds like it's less now.
And part of it is that they have moved away from the actual physical artifacts more into a digital world. There's just hasn't been, now they've got so many people inducted in the Hall of Fame that there's not room for all the plaques. So they kind of have, you push this button and you can learn about this pro. And for a while they were having some of the pros donate something from their history and they have it on display, but then they kind of took away some of the older stuff, and because they ran out of room, and then they would only have certain stuff out at each time. And I know they have to do works for them with their funding, but if it were up to me and I had a museum, I'd want all the pros to dump out all the time, but that's just me.
Well, you have tons of other stuff in here. I'll throw back to Jonathan. You've got Piper, great shot of him with Sergeant Slaughter from, they were Mid-Atlantic brothers. And the great Reggie Parks, who we miss terribly. You and I last saw him in 2019 at that CAC. But this book is tremendous. It isn't just photos, but there's tons and tons of text and history and programs and rare lineup sheets. As I said, I think before we started, Pampiro Firpo's remaining daughter of his two kids, who I'm real close with, and Jonathan, we've had her on the show, but she's going to want to see, you know, some of the programs you have with him on there when he was battling. This was before he returned in 75 to the AWA, but in 68, he was feuding with the Crusher as a heel.
Right. Yeah.
He's going to be thrilled to see.
Yeah. I still like to collect that stuff, even though I didn't start watching until 69. But I love hearing about the early days of some of the guys that had, later on I got to know, and I wish I would have been taking photos at that time, but you know, I was only able to watch it on TV at that time as an 11-year-old. But I loved the 75 feud against Raschke with Battle of the Claw Holds, and I know it was toward the end of his AWA run at that time, but it was really great to see him again at the CACs in what, probably 2000?
Yeah, it was 2000, the big one we had. I set up the table so each represented a territory. We had a ton of guys from the Detroit territory and then Ontario with Johnny Powers and stuff. But I, very briefly, I'm going to throw it to Jonathan and not talk too long. Firpo had left our LA territory, which was my home base, Los Angeles, where he was a babyface, huge babyface, teaming with Ed Carpentier, etc. He goes, finishes a fireball angle with the Sheik in Detroit, goes and debuts back after all those years in the AWA, like a 6-year absence, in the opening match, teaming with Joe LeDuc, total legend from Montreal, you know, and against two guys, and I flew in with them on the plane. They finished up their first stint in Tri-WF for Vince Sr., the Valiant Brothers. That was the opening match. The Valiants were debuting, Firpo's returning. Opening match, Valiants against Firp and Joe LeDuc. On top was, this is in Champaign, Illinois, Nick Bockwell against Billy Robinson, 5-star easy match. It's just an incredible card for a house show, regular house show, but it was packed to the gills. Standing remote.
Hanging from the rafters.
It was a really amazing card. And Von Raschke had a weird heel match with Ox Baker. It was just very weird. Fans didn't know who to cheer for, but I was marking out, taking pictures. You just didn't get to see this. So it just loaded. And Bull Belinsky, first time seeing Bull Belinsky. Jonathan, let me throw back.
I'm curious to know, because it's been, speaking of museums and everything else like that, from what I understand, and everything on the interweb is true, is it true that, Joyce, you are a collector of a lot of wrestling memorabilia?
That is true. My husband is an extremely understanding individual about hobbies, and
so he's automatically earned his angel wings in.
Yes, he has. He absolutely has. So in the lower level of our house, I have basically an AWA collectibles museum that a posters there really wasn't that much AWA marketed stuff, but some of the guys like Dr. X and would do their own marketing. But I have a lot of Crusher memorabilia, posters, some of the posters from Japan, Raschke memorabilia from some of the stuff he's marketed, and basically some of my favorites. I was able to bid on and obtain Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel's trunks, which they tease me about regularly. And they did say, I better not see you trying those on, or I better not hear that your husband tried them on. I said, no, they're in a case. Don't. I guess I think that there should be a museum for this stuff. And because there isn't a place yet that I feel would treat it with the proper respect for the AWA.
Actually, there is. It's my house.
You should start one, Joyce. You should start one, because then you know it's going to be honest and ethical.
If it's honest and ethical, I'm out.
But we had that problem when the Buffalo, Tony Villano got out of it for a brief time and sold it all. It went to Fort Worth. I won't name the retired wrestler who took it over, but people were starting to see the stuff on eBay, and the museum had weird times. It was just a mess, and Tony Villano started feuding with this guy and decided, I guess, to restart. I don't know the status of the upstate, you know, because where he had it, Jonathan and I would love to go up there. They had a baseball. It wasn't that far from Cooperstown, the baseball.
Yeah, I think they had the right idea. I'm a little concerned that they have started partnering with the WWE on things and loaning stuff.
No, that's no good. All they do is hoard stuff.
That's, yeah. So I've been concerned it's going to end up in a warehouse that nobody's ever going to see it then. So, and then the same way with the Iowa Museum, so much of it ended up down in the basement, and they had a flood, and I just didn't feel like it was.
But that's when Mike Chapman got booted out. They were mad. He got kicked out by the own board that he put on the board. All these folks, he got kicked out of his own museum he started, because they had that horrific flood and tornadoes and massive rain, and stuff sadly got ruined. And in my will, a lot of my stuff is supposed to go there, but now I'm having second thoughts about the Thez
tribute. Yeah, yeah.
So we started, I think. And one last thing, I don't know if you get the Vern Gagne board game, but in 1991 at a New York Weekend of Champions convention, I'm the last guy standing bidding against Jim Cornette for this 1963 Vern Gagne board game. And I eventually gave in, but he was pissed that
I do have one. I'll have to leave that to you in my will if I go first there, Mike.
We'll just come back on the show and then give us a tour. Jonathan probably want to see a visual tour of all your collectibles.
I stand here and with Mike and stuff. I wasn't put in a will. What the hell?
Well, I just met you, Jonathan.
No, I'm not. That's why I said Mike.
I'm refinessing my will and trust, so I can leave stuff to my friends.
But I also have a unopened can of Dynapower from Vern Gagne, if you can believe that. I would never open it and use it now, but it was from like the late 60s. It was like a powdered drink you put in milk or so to supposedly enhance your muscles.
They call those steroids.
It's like it was like powdered Seago. Remember Seago?
Yes, yes. Back in the
60s for dieting.
He was quite the marketer for himself, but there wasn't a whole lot of other stuff out there for the AWA guys. But I was lucky enough to run into a guy that used to do the printing for some of the AWA cards and posters, and I got him for a steal at the time. He was selling them at a collectible show, and now I've seen similar posters go for 10 times what I got these for. So, but I'm, you know, to me they're priceless. I would never want to sell them. So, you got to collect what you love, and you just have to know that there's got to be a plan. So I've talked to some people and said, if something happens to me, I want this to go to you and to you or something. But it's really hard to get hold of some of this stuff because it was so limited.
Well, my final question is, and obviously it's been mentioned with the book, that Sergeant Slaughter did the forward and such. You mentioned you wanted to have credibility per se from an outside source on the book. But why, of all the people you've encountered through the years, why was it Sarge that you said, okay, I want you as a to do my forward?
Pretty much because, well, there's very few AWA wrestlers still around, for one thing. If Nick had been alive and been in his right mind, I certainly would have wanted him as well. But I first met Sarge when he was being the Super Destroyer Mark II, managed by Lord Alfred Hayes in 1978, back in the AWA. So we've known each other for 45 years, and he was it was total kayfabe at that time, so nobody was supposed to know who he was and where he came from. He's supposed to be from Gibraltar, and but I found out he was very much a fan growing up, and that he enjoyed watching Joe Scarpello and Vern Gagne, and went through the camp, and so he knew the AWA history, and he still spoke highly of it, and had always been friends with me, and always remembered me anytime he saw me, even after he was hugely famous in the WWE and through all the different machinations of his Sergeant Slaughter image, even when he was an Iraqi sympathizer, if you will. But he always remembered me and said, and I was looking for somebody to write the foreword, and I couldn't think of anybody. I even kind of asked Greg about it, and while Greg didn't come out right out and say no, he just said, I haven't had real good luck with books. I just don't get involved in that stuff, and I don't think books really sell that much, so I really don't. You know, maybe someday, you know, and after I get done with all the Remco figures, you know, I could come back on, look at it. And I was kind of needing somebody before that. And when I asked for it, he said it'd be an honor. And I wasn't sure. I thought I'd have to push him, but he wrote it and got it to me right away. He said, when do you need it? And I said, well, by like last summer. And he wrote it out, and he said, you can edit it how you want, but he said, I tried to put in a lot of stuff about how I remembered that we met, and so I was very pleased with how he did it, and just, he's always been a true gentleman, and just a real supporter to me, and he did a promo with me on it, and then, you know, ordering people to buy the book, and he's just been a real help to me. Always asks about it.
I always wanted to talk to Sarge because I think he'd be a fun conversation. But I just want to see if Mike is paying attention here. But the name Joe Scarpo, she just mentioned. Who was that, if fans aren't aware?
Well, he was a wrestler. Wasn't he primarily enhancement? But he was... yeah. Helped train various guys. He was a great talent. You know, a lot of the enhancement guys were very skilled. They just, their trouble sometimes was their look, or they were a little bit smaller, like Mike Pappas or someone like that. But they were still, there would be no wrestling without those kind of guys.
He had been a great amateur star and had really done well in the amateur ranks, but just never really caught on because he didn't have a gimmick. But Vern always took care of him and said, you know, you'll have a job with me for life. But the fact that it was enhancement talent, like you said, was one thing. But Sarge remembered him from the early 60s.
Blair was enhancement talent. He was
starting out.
He was pudgy in like 74. He was jobbing to everybody. And that footage was on Wide World of Sports of Chris Taylor defeating and bear hugging Ric Flair. Yeah. So you can... You know,
You never know where somebody's gonna take off. When and Baron was the same way. You know, he started out as Jim Raschke, and He'll even admit that he was a terrible interview when he first started out, but then when he became the Baron later, people didn't recognize him from before, and he was now a heel, So they just need a gimmick sometime that people can latch on to.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say some chapters in here that are must read. Chicago in the Big Time. You talk about the museum. You have a whole chapter on Kenny J, on the Baron, on AWA Legends, of course. But a lot of these big cities, Minneapolis and the Bockwinkel Brigade, which was the name of Nick's fan club, driving the boys. So I'm sure we didn't even ask you about road stories with the guys, and maybe your thoughts on why there was a scarcity of female wrestlers until first Sherry Martel. Some would come in, but I don't think Vern actively ever used Moolah's talent. And Sherry and then Medusa, and then sort of it opened up a pathway, especially once Medusa then went to All Japan Women. Candy Devine and some others would come in there, and they created a women's AWA title.
Yeah, what I liked about using the women, pretty much he used Vivian Bishan and Jean Antone and Kay Noble. Those were the three that I remember from when I first started watching. And it was pretty much a once a year thing because it was a novelty. And I think he thought there would be just kind of oversaturation of it if he did it very often. But he would bring in the women once a year, and it was a big deal then. Later when I remember being very impressed with both Candy Devine and Sherry Martel as being really athletic and wanting to bring a lot of credibility to the women's side. I hated what happened when in the WWE when they went to more the diva side or women that couldn't wrestle at all and just were, some basically models that, couldn't do any holds. I liked that they were athletic and could do the holds. I would, even for a probably 2 month time, I considered, gee, I should have gone into wrestling, but I wouldn't have had the dedication or the athleticism to do it. And I needed a real job so I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt. But I have great admiration for the women of that time and the amount of risk that they took and the hurdles that they had to go through to make a living, especially people like Marie Laverne and Beverly Shade and Debbie Combs to some degree and a lot of the Moolah's stable. They really worked hard to get booked and to have credibility. And I don't think a lot of the guys at the time really appreciated them as athletes. I think it was really hard for them to get accepted into that profession.
Remember the AWA's own Steve Olsonowski working as Steve O for Ole Anderson, who made his name as Rock Rogowski in the AWA. But Steve had the first, I think, or at least well-known national match against the female. And he's an AWA guy because, Vern always stressed he really liked people from the amateurs and true athletic guys like a Dale Lewis, amateur greats and greats in other sports. But I just want to say, everybody, this belongs in your collection. It's a fascinating read. I'm just partially through it. I can't put it down. My Ringside Seat to the AWA by Joyce Pausman. Joyce, let's have you plug your social media and where you want to send people to get the book. Your website, of course.
Yeah. I decided to have it and do this independently. So I sell it at some of the various fan events at a table, but I also send it out by mail, joycepaustian.com, joycepaustian.com. You can read all about the book on there. It's a very easy website to navigate. and you can order it right through there, except PayPal through there, and I have quick turnaround time and very safely mailed, and you'll have it within a week usually. And I've even sold a couple of them internationally. I've sent a couple to England and to Canada, a little more postage that way, but I haven't had any dissatisfied customers yet. So
you know, it's on first class paper too. The photos are outstanding. I mean, I'm looking at Von Raschke putting the claw on Dick the Bruiser. Fantastic shot you took, and you show the series. There's Andre, photos of Andre, Saito and Ken Patera. I can't get enough of Billy Robinson, obviously, and just
got his ass kicked by Sarge, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah,
Ivan Koloff, or there's Vachon's all over the place. Rene Goulet, who was a mainstay there way before he got to the WWF or Tri-WF.
Yeah, we were very lucky in the AWA, is in that almost every major star came through there at one time or another in the 70s and 80s. You know, people that didn't see the AWA until the tail end in the mid 80s really don't know how lucky we were, but it was a major league at the time. Maybe not to the level that the NWA was or the WWF was at the time, but certainly the talent was top notch, and we had the benefit of seeing some of the greats at the beginning of their career. And almost every star that Vern put through his camp later became a major star. And so I think almost everybody had good things to say about it. Even Bobby Heenan had great things to say about his time in the AWA. So I feel very blessed that I was able to be around and photograph during that time, even if I didn't start as young as I would have liked to. But and then just making the connections again through the Cauliflower Alley and photographing with you, some of the it was great to see those legends again and to see them get some awards and see the fans remember them and see them get the accolades they deserved.
Is that you with a Minolta? They've got a shot which I've never seen.
Yeah, it's actually a Pentax.
Right on the cover there in the ring.
Yeah, that's me. I mean, obviously not in the ring. I was at the ring, but it was a photo that my friend Connie took, and I thought, oh, that'll make a great cover, because you know, that's the way I felt. Was like, there I am down here, and these stars are just, I'm in awe of all of them, and I feel really lucky that I was able to photograph them and meet so many of them. It was a great way to get to know some of them, is to say, hey, I took this picture of you, you know, would you mind signing it? And they'd say, you took that picture? Where'd you get that? And I was like, can I get a copy of that? And you know, and then we'd have a conversation, and it's like, how'd you get started taking pictures? You know? So it was fun. And then so many of them would remember me as like, hey, have you taken any pictures of me lately? So,
one last thing. We lost Butcher Paul Vachon.
Yeah.
Loved getting up, working out with him in the 90s at Cauliflower Alley when we were still in LA, and hearing his stories of him against, I forget which of the Singhs in India, but he said drawing 80,000, Dara Singh, 100,000 at another show, yeah, like in the 50s. And Paul Vachon was like a walking history book. And
so willing to talk to people at CAC, and especially in the early days. He had always had a table there and had written some early, you know, self-published books of his own and T-shirts. And he was always so willing to sit and talk to people and play cribbage and just reminisce with fans, and or just tell them all about his career. Yeah.
In the Dick Beyer, the Destroyer / Dr. X, trade the CAC cribbage championship every year. They were like swapping the belt.
it was really funny, you know, that I, because I remember Dr. X and Larry Hennig having a feud in the AWA early on when they were going back and forth, and Dr. X calling Larry a frog, a toad, you know, and ribbit, ribbit, ribbit. And so then seeing the two of them playing cribbage together, you know, 40 years later, it was just funny to see like the two of them back together, you know. And yeah, he's another, Dick Byers, another one I miss greatly. He, what a nice guy, and what a promoter of the CAC and wrestling in general, and just all the trips around the world that he made. Yeah, great guy.
He was the first wrestler to have his own variety show in Japan, where he sang and danced.
Yeah, one of the collectibles that I searched for the longest was he had a Scripto View lighter. That had that him as the Destroyer, and I was they had pens and lighters that they would sell in the magazines, and I thought, well, that's kind of an odd thing to market to kids, but I finally found one, and on eBay I paid way too much for it, but I still have it at least. So, but it was one of those things that, you know, you think, this is one thing I got to find from my collection.
Let me throw back to Jonathan. Jonathan, maybe we could have Joyce back on and have her give us an actual tour in her pro wrestling museum in the basement.
We can do that.
We'll try to set that up. I'm not sure how good my Wi-Fi is down in the basement, but we can work on setting that up.
Sounds good. Joyce, and make sure, before I say that, everybody, make sure you check the link provided. Go get a copy of Joyce's book. But Joyce, thank you so much.
Happy to send it out to you.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me on. And thank you, Mike, for making the connection. And, it's been a pleasure.
Congratulations. Great book.
Hey there, Friday fans. We know how much you enjoy the movies. Enjoy grabbing your Friday merchandise and interacting with the Friday family, whether it be at conventions or during our particular watch-alongs. Well, when you're looking to get yourself masks, why not check out our friends over at Camp Blood Customs out of New York State, and order your specific custom mask from any of the films. All orders are made specifically. Your needs and wants are. Make sure you find Camp Blood Customs on Facebook, Instagram, and all over social media, and order yours today.
Hi, this is Adrienne Barbeau, and you're listening to Crazy Train Radio.